Hello and welcome to the first Morning Energy Live of 2025. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and today I am lucky to have with me a good friend and student of the natural gas markets, CFO of EQT, Jeremy Knop. And if you've been reading anything we've been putting out recently, you know that the markets are laser focused on power and gas, or as Jeremy would like to think of it, gas and power. Having spent some time both as an investor and an operator, Jeremy brings some unique insights to the discussion. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Yeah, good to be here.
Okay, before we get started, I got a few questions for you so our listeners can get to know you better. Ready?
Let's do it.
Yes, we're gonna go with yes. Okay, what is the first concert you ever went to?
First concert I ever went to. So I grew up in Austin, Texas. Obviously a big music scene. First concert I went to in high school was actually Jet. Good rock band, which I actually still listen to sometimes.
Sweet. A little throwback there. All right, next question. Beach or mountains? Now remember, this is a year-round commitment, not seasonal. What do you pick?
Mountains every time.
No question. All right, well, we can agree to disagree on that. Next question. Have you been to more countries or states?
I've been to most of the 50 states at this point, so I don't think I've been to that many countries.
Wow. All right. A
So
little bucket
I got
list
some
left
work to
there to
do.
do. All right. Well, we can see, 25 could be your year, all 50. Just find some oil and gas in, I don't know, Tennessee. Or you've been there already. Okay.
Lot of road
Next
trips growing
question.
up. I checked a lot
Next.
of boxes.
Good stuff. All right. This is a new one for our guests. Who do you admire most professionally?
Professionally? Man, I could give you a long list of those people. What if I was sitting at home right now, what you'd see usually sitting behind me is a frame of something my wife gave me, which is a keyboard signed by Steve Jobs, Steve Wozniak, and Paul Allen. And I've always admired Steve Jobs a lot because one, he failed hard, hit rock bottom, bounced back. Two, I think he was a master of thinking outside the box. The whole Think Different Apple campaign I've always found fascinating. And I think he did an incredible job of taking a lot of complexity and distilling it down to something very simple. And I think, for all of us in professionally what we do, I think the essence of what makes you really good at what you do is just taking complexity and making it simple. And I think Apple is the perfect representation of that. So if there's any way to do that like Steve Jobs did, I think it leads to success in whatever you do.
I mean, when my 2-year-old and child and 80-year-old grandmother can use the same device with the same ease, I mean, you
Amazing.
got it. All right, final question. What is the best sandwich?
There is a sandwich shop near Greenway Plaza in Houston called Little Jimmy's. It
Not
is
to
to
be
this
confused
day,
with Jimmy John's.
not to be confused with Jimmy John's. Little Jimmy's is still one of my favorite sandwich spots. I have not been there in too long, but I love going back.
Well, I'm sure they love the free advertising. So, all right. Well, that's great. Thank you very much. All right. So, real quick, why don't you give the listeners a quick background on you so they know how you got here? Not to Morning Energy Live, but to be CFO of EQT.
Yeah, of course. So I've been at EQT for what is it, almost 4 years, 5 years. I joined in early 2021. I originally joined to run our M&A strategy. I'd spent about 9 years at Blackstone before that, working more on the credit side of things. And I kind of came to a view probably in 2018 that, if we're to invest money with the best teams and the best assets, increasingly they shouldn't be taking, money from someone wanting to earn a mid-teens return or higher. And in the long run, as the industry matured and shale matured, it needed to be all operated by the most efficient operators, the lowest cost structure, because cost structure is all that really matters. And you hear us talk about that a lot at EQT. And I had known the Rices since probably 2012. Actually, almost went to work for them in 2013.
Sounds
And
like a little bit of
so,
a miss
I
there,
had been
but
in
okay.
little bit. It all worked out all right.
Yeah.
And so I've been just talking to them over the years, and it just worked out well for, I think, where I was in my career and what Toby was doing at EQT, and didn't have his brothers there for this round. It was perfect timing for both of us, and one thing led to the other. We're successful very quickly on the M&A side, and then CFO job opened up, and it was a pretty natural fit. And so we've really pulled a lot of that together internally. And then before I worked at Blackstone, I worked at Lehman Barclays in the investment bank, kind of traditional 2-year program after school. But I have always lived in Houston, even though I have yet to work for a company based in Texas. So keeping the streak alive.
Wow, keep up the good work. I'm impressed. I mean,
Brian.
I've lived in New York my whole life and worked for a company in Calgary the last 10 years. So, I feel you. I feel you there. All right, now down to business. So now the U.S. finally has two new demand sources, right? We got for gas, we got LNG that we knew about, and now this new power demand that we learned more about last year, a little bonus. Are we finally going to see sustained prices above $3, $4?
So it's an interesting question. I'll answer this with a little spin to it. So I think on average prices need to be in the $4 to $5 range over the longer term. I think in our view at EQT, while we have remained in Appalachia, we've looked at assets everywhere because we can learn a lot just from a macro fundamentals perspective. And we have a view that a lot of the core Haynesville inventory is depleted. By the end of the decade, you'll be pretty well exhausted. Plays like the Utica probably end up in around the same time frame. Marcellus is in the Permian or in kind of a different class. So to be able to actually motivate that gas growth that you're going to need in a world where everybody is increasingly running their company for shareholders and focused on return on capital, that return on your drilling and completion dollars, that leads to a very different outcome in terms of what actually motivates you to spend. And so I think you do need to see those price signals probably much higher. I don't think you're going to see producers chasing a 350, four handle in gas anymore. I think what is different, though, is that if you look at and we have a slide in our investor presentation on this, I think it's slide 21, but if you look at the 10 years prior to 2020, gas prices on a settled basis, if you were to bin it by like every 50 cents, it looks like a very perfect normal distribution of outcomes. If you look at the distribution since then, 60% of the time prices are sub $3. And most of the rest of the time prices are above $4. You don't see a lot of price settlement actually in that middle range. I think that's going to be much more characteristic for the world we're in going forward because you have renewables, which are intermittent. You have less coal for substitution in the power stack. Then you have LNG. And when you don't have enough storage capacity to back that LNG, price is really the only variable left to balance inventories. And in all commodities, whether it's oil in 2020 or copper or whatever it might be, you're never going to run to the point of scarcity. And you're never going to totally like fill up tank tops or overrun storage. Price will always move to a level to fix that. So in our view, I think you're going to see gas prices either in that sub $3 range most of the time, or in a really, really high, price point most of the time. I think actually hanging out where we are right now as we're transitioning in this $3 to $4 range, I think that's going to be less and less. And so we're trying to build our business specifically to not really worry about the sub $3 world, which I think you're going to see still plenty of outcomes in, but it's going to then ricochet all the way to that $4 plus world. And that's when you just simply don't want to be hedged. So I think that it's just the character that market is changing.
Well, I mean, it seems like we're going to have a sloppy 25 as we think about how many rigs are drilling now, where we see production and where we see demand based on certainly the LNG, which is more visible, and then the uncertainty of demand around power that's coming. So, yeah, the mismatch is always hard, and we like to think of that as opportunity, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, just to give an example, Gillick, like if you're, I mean, we're producing over 100 BCF a day. If your supply demand model over the course of the year is off by 1%, so 1 BCF a day times 365 days, that's the difference between a pretty bearish market, like bad, like sub $3, and a market that is $4 plus. And none of us are good enough with weather and all the variables to estimate in any even close to that. So that's what drives to that very unpredictable style of
Right.
outcomes.
Right. The next question I wanted to ask you about was about some of the Appalachian operators stepping out of the basin, but I think you kind of answered that question in and around, how you think of inventory. However, as this LNG demand expands, wouldn't being closer to the Gulf Coast be a benefit for an operator?
Yeah, I think, look, in our view, a lot of that will get filled up by the Permian. And the Permian will become a big gas play in time. By our estimates, Permian produces about 20 BCF a day today. By 2030, we think it's probably close to 30, so 10 BCF a day of growth. You've seen three big pipelines or expansions announced in the past 6 months or so. That'll add nearly 5 Bs a day by the end of 2026, approximately. So you're going to see that rapid build out. Now, oil prices, if just due to the global supply demand picture, if they weaken, maybe that the timing of it slows a little bit. But there's a lot of gas in the Permian, so it's not something that I think we worry as much about. Now, if we can build new pipes out of Appalachia, fantastic. But I mean, there's ample gas to go around, I think, for the time being.
Well, so if not in basin, I mean, not stepping out of basin, what about in basin, either for you or what do you expect in terms of M&A in the gas space, this year?
Yeah, so M&A across the market is definitely not done. I think it's gonna transition more from being public to private and more public to public. I think
Got it.
for us, when we look at Appalachia, we have always had a view, and I'd say the Permian's the same way. There's certain haves of inventory and a lot of have-nots, and you'll see a reallocation of that pie within Appalachia. In the past 12 months, I think specifically what's also changed is this power demand theme.
Yeah.
And in our view, I think by the end of the decade, we think Appalachia needs to be producing 40 to 42 BCF a day versus 35 to 36 today. That is the equivalent of almost an entire additional EQT. And when I look at even our business, and now we control all the pipelines, so it makes growth easier. Even adding 2 to 3% production growth between like ourselves, Range, and Antero, whoever really has inventory left, that still doesn't fill that, right? And so I think you'll see basis actually be a tailwind, is our view. And you've seen that continue to tighten. It was probably $1.15 back in 2025, about a year ago. It's about 80 cents back today. And I think over time that probably averages 50 to 80 cents. So I actually think that's a tailwind. I think that actually allows the Appalachian producers who have been patient and have real inventory left to actually add like perpetual growth back to the business to fill that demand and also backfill the declines of those who run out of inventory. So I don't think any other play really offers that. In the Permian, you can certainly grow. The Haynesville, you grow for 2 years and then you just go into decline because you don't have the inventory to support it, at least in our view. So I think that setup is pretty unique, and I think for us, looking to step out of Appalachia just increasingly doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, and if the new administration is as business friendly as it claims to be and as pro energy as the headlines are suggesting, that should offer potentially some opportunity for broader infrastructure build out within the basin. And so you mentioned pipes. And so I'm coming up on like my 20th anniversary of being involved in the energy sector. Like maybe I passed my 20th anniversary of being involved in the energy sector, which means I've seen a couple of cycles. And sometimes investors, they want pure play operators. Sometimes they want integrated companies. Sometimes they don't know what they want. I feel like often they don't know what they want. But we saw EQT buy EQM, right? Suggesting that you think we're ready for that integrated model again. Does that mean that one's better at math versus others? Like, what's the current advantage here as you think about it today versus what, maybe was happening 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, I mean, there was a period during the shale boom where it was all about growth and high quality cash flow, whether it's midstream or minerals, was sold off at a high financial multiple, and it was really ended up being kind of busted financial math that helped fund a lot of the upstream growth. The problem is, I think the math on the upstream growth was all wrong, right? You're not actually creating 100% rate of returns for shareholders. by drilling a well at 100% rate of return. It's really a fraction of that when you break the math down. And I think that all sort of unwound. And what we ended up doing as an industry is creating all these upstream-only companies who are very fragile. And then when you meet these bouts of volatility, which is natural in the commodity markets, whether it's 2015 or 2020 or whatever comes next, you just kept seeing them all break. I think predictably in hindsight. And so, you know, that made a lot of upstream just uninvestable. And so as we were talking to a lot of the big long only shareholders, the theme I heard in essence was, I want something that is gas, but looks like Conoco, that looks like Exxon, that is easy to own, where I am not having to sit here and worry about, is winter cold? Is it warm? How much is power growing this year versus renewables?
Yeah.
But rather, if I'm bullish gas for the next decade, two decades, you'll give me a steady dividend. I don't have to stay up at night worrying about it. If gas spikes 1 year, I have most of the exposure to it. If gas collapses 1 year for 2 years, I'm not worried about losing my investment. And so it's really coming back to like just making a really good business again. And then for us, I think because we were disintegrated and got misaligned with Equitrans, you know, a lot of things we've talked about around like system pressures and some of that, there was a lot of synergies that we saw that would actually improve our upstream performance. And so for us, it was really like you put Humpty Dumpty back together again, and you just make a much better company. And yeah. it's pretty fascinating because, you know, you go sit down with some of the biggest, you know, these multi-trillion-dollar long-only investment houses, and usually the first question we hear now is, why didn't you guys do this deal 2 to 3 years ago? It's so obvious in hindsight. Who else can do this? Will every one of your peers do this? Right? And
Well, not every one of your peers can do it. I mean, maybe some can.
Almost none of them can, right? And that's, I think, what's unique to us. And we're trying to create a bit of a differentiated story in that sense. And I'd say the other thing, too, that was interesting for us is we did these big firm supply deals to two of the massive utilities in the Southeast in late 2023. And they paid us a big premium for the gas over index. And we at the time couldn't quite figure out why they would be willing to do that. And it led us down the road of really studying power and trying to understand all this. And it really occurred to us that a lot of these gas pipes were really undervalued because there was a lot of growth coming back, that the scarcity value of those pipes and of the gas flowing through them was only going to increase. And so we moved pretty quickly once we had a window, once it looked like MVP was going to get done, to buy it back in Equitrans. And I mean, timing is fortunate. I don't think we'd have been able to do that today because midstream multiples have totally re-rated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think when you look at it and you see all the consolidation and generally the, you know, the upstream business is considered mature and investors are looking for that return of capital, right? That it makes sense that you would want a little bit more of an integrated, stable business to in the go forward situation. So I get that makes sense. All right, one more question before we start talking about gas and power here. So as I mentioned, I've seen some cycles, and when I started, the U.S. was primed to be the world's LNG dumping ground. Yes, Cheniere was not a liquefaction project, but a regas facility. And now here we are arguing about how much more export capacity we should be building. In your view, like, should we be building more liquefaction capacity, or did Biden actually do everybody a favor, or do the U.S. producers a favor?
Yeah, it's a great question. Look, in our view, like, gas demand will structurally keep growing internationally for the next several decades, and there's so much coal still being burned.
Globally.
In the U.S., there's probably about 15 BCF a day equivalent of coal being burned. Internationally, it's, you know, north of 100. So the opportunity globally is just so much greater. I think the issue is when you look at the U.S. and what caused coal to be replaced, it wasn't the government saying it needs to be replaced. It was a price war between gas and coal.
Yeah.
In essence, when you look back at it, how those two traded against each other, I think the
I
same
also
thing
think
has
it was like
out.
The environmental movement. Let's be honest; like there were some loud voices that were pushing for change.
No, that certainly plays a factor. But for someone to put capital out and convert a coal plant or shut it down or invest in something else, it's that relative return that is really driving is capital actually funding it or not. But the point is, I think internationally, if you look at India or anyone in Southeast Asia, you know, their cost of coal today is $6 to $8 on an MMBTU basis.
Okay.
So for LNG to displace coal internationally, it's got to ultimately that's going to be driven by that arb and price war between gas and coal. So you do need a lot more gas internationally. I think we do have to be careful about getting too excited about LNG is something where the arb is always going to be wide open, whether you're an, you know, a Cheniere or Venture Global making a lot of money marketing gas today, because that arb is making you so much money for your marketed volumes. I don't think that exists in the perpetuity. You know, by nature, an arb is meant to be closed. But it's gonna be open and it's gonna be closed for different periods of time. I do think, while I don't, you know, I'm very much a more of a libertarian free market guy, I hate seeing the government get involved and stop private enterprise from building what we think is needed. But I do think to some degree the euphoria over LNG after the Ukraine invasion, it was certainly tempered by what Biden did. And in hindsight, I think probably led to a little bit more disciplined capital allocation to the best projects first, as
Sure.
opposed to a massive wave way too quickly of LNG that just dumped in the global market and really caused a global oversupply for years. I think
Yeah, it
there's
may
still
have.
risk of that just
Yeah.
from a timing mismatch. I think there's a timing mismatch in favor of too little supply in the next 2 years. It could flip after that, and it flips again. So it's going to keep moving in cycles.
Yeah, I got the sense that okay, let's slow it down. And before we even started thinking about the new domestic demand source, right? And so I think it served, you know, one that was fortuitous on that end, but also to your point, more discipline, which is always important. Like how many times have we seen investors throw money at things that they think, you know, especially in the energy space are going to be, you know, the new thing. But you know, tempering that is good. Okay. So do you think that the market sort of shifted away now, thinking about LNG because of this domestic need, because of all the headlines around power and power growth for the first time in a generation, and now the administration pushing forward more of a hydrocarbon agenda than others? Like, is LNG on the back burner for investors, or I mean, venture global IPO aside, or potential IPO aside? We'll see how that goes. But where do you think the mindset is here in the U.S.?
Yeah, I mean, if you rewind 2 or 3 years, the pitch for buying and owning gas was LNG. That has evolved, and at the time you still had coal retirement. So over the past decade, from like 2014 to 2024, we've probably added 10 to 12 BCF a day of gas demand in the thermal stack, displacing coal. So the power story has been there for gas already, but that was in the face of flat load. And so I think what's changing now is you kind of have a third leg to the demand stool beyond LNG, beyond coal retirements, and that is absolute load growth. And that's after, you know, this last, call it 5 years of sort of irrational exuberance around green energy and renewables, and you don't need fossil fuels anymore. I think everyone's woken up to say, like, that just doesn't make any sense, right? Even if you pair solar with, you know, 12 hours of batteries, that's going to cost you 4 times as much as a new combined cycle plant. It just doesn't make a lot of sense, and you still don't have the reliability. And so as we look at that, and as we talk to, you know, different users of gas, different utilities, even some of the hyperscalers who we've talked to, I think that the script is totally flipped. I think the administration change, I mean, certainly helps with that to some degree. I mean, in my mind, seeing guys like John Arnold, now Dana White, of all people, on the board of Meta, it does signal that mentalities are changing. It's coming back from, you know, where the pendulum, I think, had overswung too far to one side, to something that's more balanced. And I think in our view, gas being like a long-term transition fuel, or really if you fast forward like 30, 40 years, maybe it's like nuclear plus gas. I think people are starting to realize that with a little bit more of like a balanced way of looking at it.
From my seat, it just seems like there are a lot of parties interested in what's going on in the US because of the amount of capital or the velocity of capital pushing forward the AI agenda, right? It's so clear to me that it's a national security issue. It's not just a, oh, this is a cool tech bro thing, right? It's something that the country is focused on, right? And while there's still interest in solar and batteries, and that can be part of the solution stack, it's the reliability or the dispatchability of gas that that I think the markets are going to be very focused on. And I don't think that that's changing anytime soon. And so when we look at it, we look at, okay, where are there underutilized plants? Where can we put new plants? And how long will it take? And so I guess from your seat, how are you thinking about EQT participating in this rush, right? Because on the one hand, we have what you just described. On the other hand, you still have the exporters, those that have, you know, capacity in the liquefaction facilities who are looking to lock in gas, right? So I feel like there's actually going to be a little bit more competition. We can talk about that later. But back to you, EQT, and your participation on the power side, how are you thinking about that as an advantage for you?
Yeah, and I think it's a great question, because it's important to differentiate like who within the gas space even has the ability to participate. So if you think about it, if you're a Duke Energy, you are not going to do a long-term gas supply deal with a $5 billion sub-investment grade gas company, right? It just, like, you can't for 10 years, 15 years depend on that supply. The counterparty credit ratings matter a lot. That's why we Expand, others have been so focused on getting rock solid IG ratings. And then beyond that, I think you have to have the right team that can structure creative deals. And certainly having the midstream piece of that, we're seeing our integrated model, I think, is a key differentiator in that, because we can supply the gas to a new facility separate from saying, hey, I have to tie into TECO or to TETCO or one of these other pipelines, where they're going to be rate cases. Are you going to have that capacity the whole time? Is your supply going to be able to get from over the next 20 years, 15 years, where you're producing it into the pipe to that end user? Do you have enough inventory to really support that? It when you start thinking with duration, that equation gets a lot harder. And so I think for us, being able to control the full value chain is a key differentiator of that. So we're seeing a lot of unique opportunities come to us. I think, you know, I'm trying to think outside the box a lot about what are the right structures to put together to pitch for some of these. But I think the I'm becoming more optimistic about it. I think, you know, a year ago, we were probably one of the first gas companies to really start talking about this. I think we said specifically, like, this whole AI power data center theme is really taking the torch from LNG. And at the time, I kind of worried, thinking, like, man, are we getting too excited about this too early? Or are we over-optimistic about what those estimates could look like? And really, I think from where we sit today, in the latest conversations we're having, I think those actually might be too conservative of estimates. I think those are probably moving higher. But I think 2025 is going to be a big year from that, where it goes from hype to, or deals actually getting signed. But the key constraints right now are really in the turbine market.
Yeah,
it's in the permitting side of things. The scarcity is in power. The scarcity is not in gas. And so it's, how do you link all of that together? And in essence, if you were to break it down into like a single trade, like, you want to be long the spark spread. We've done firm supply deals with the biggest utilities in the Southeast on a like index plus basis. We have a deal with another power plant for almost $100 million a day, where we just get PJM netback pricing. I think we're thinking about other structures beyond that to get exposure. But the deals we've done to date support about 9 gigawatts of new gas-fired generation. So I think we're in a great spot to capture whatever comes our way. But we're seeing the hyperscalers warm up to gas pretty rapidly.
Yeah, we've been noticing the same thing. And the conventional wisdom is that the hyperscalers in particular are going to want the security of being connected into the grid. But there's still a lot of talk around behind the meter, right, of the hyperscalers building their own gas plants or their own power gen facilities. What's your sense there? Do you feel like we're going to have more one way or the other? Obviously, time to market is very, very crucial for these folks.
Yeah, I think one of the more interesting plays we've seen recently are developers taking old coal plants that already have interconnections to the grid and converting them to gas. Because they can jump that regulatory queue easier. It doesn't help you get turbines quicker from Mitsubishi or GE or whoever you're buying from.
Right.
But
that's still interconnect, right? So that's still,
it's still an interconnect.
Connected.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. One deal we're looking at right now is behind the meter deal.
Sure.
If you're going to be behind the meter, you need extra redundancy, though. You need to overbuild the capacity for maintenance purposes, whether it's pipe access or whether it's the actual generation capacity. If you say, I need a gigawatt, you might need to build like one and a quarter, because you're going to have to take plants down for maintenance, and you can't tell the data center you require five nines of reliability, which is you can only be down like 24 minutes a year. Like, that doesn't work if you're depending on batteries or you don't have backup options. So I think the point of interconnects, even if you build behind the grid today, I do think they're going to want to tie into the grid in time.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me too. I think speed to market is key, but I also think that the reliability is as important or more important, right? Like you can't do it if you're not getting your just 26 minutes of downtime a year. So what do you think the so yeah so it sounds like 25 is going to be a year of discovery, right? We're going to figure out what does that market really look like. You think it could be more, other people think it could be less, some people think AI is fake. I tend to agree, sorry, disagree with that thesis. So what do you think the first, like, and we saw Exxon sort of announce that they're building a gas-fired plant. What do you think the first deal in your region is going to look like, whether it's you or somebody else?
I think there's a couple in the queue that are pretty interesting right now. I think the bigger you build it, the more economies of scale you can certainly have. But each one of these, I mean, the capital invested, excuse me, capital invested is massive. So if you're building a gigawatt facility, that sort of the box might cost you 10 billion. And then you might install 30 billion of chips inside of it, right? I mean, the amount is absolutely enormous. So I think the bigger these facilities are, like, there's no issue with gas supply, right? If we're to build a pipeline direct to a facility and supply the gas and just a package deal, whether the pipe is, 24 inches, 12 inches, 32 inches, like, it just doesn't really matter. And so I think it really comes down to where's the right location. Are you close to fiber? We can get gas most places in Southwest Appalachia. EQT, I think the way we think about ourselves is, we're a one-stop shop solution. There's a big data center build out not only in Northern Virginia, but also in
By the way,
Ohio.
Embarrass thinks of ourselves as a one-stop shop solution too. Should just
It,
tell your
it,
friends.
yeah, it's a good pitch, Andrew. That's all you need, right? You don't worry about anybody else. Just go to the one-stop shop.
It. Just come here. Come here.
Yeah, but look, I think it's something where we all sell a commodity product. The question is, how do you pitch something that's a differentiated solution? And that's really the nut we're trying to crack right now.
No, that totally makes sense. I mean, look, I think in the last 12 months, the outlook for the North American energy industry has gone from wah wah to really, really exciting. Not because it's shifted away from renewables or towards renewables, only that it's in focus and clear that, we need that reliability in this, global AI race. So very, very exciting times to come. So we're just about out of time. Last question. Who's going to win this weekend? Bills or Chiefs? Not who you want to win. And you can't take any points. Straight up.
I have always been a big Chiefs fan, but I would love to see Josh Allen advance. I think
No
he deserves
problem.
it.
No problem with that prediction right there. Bills Mafia. Let's go. Jeremy, thank you
If
very
I
much.
threw the option to my son, he's going to pick Josh Allen. So I'll go with Josh Allen.
There you go. Doing it for the kids. All right. Well, Jeremy, thank you very much for your time today. It's been great. And thanks to everyone for tuning in. See you next time. Well, that was fun.
Are we off?